The team seemed to be digesting the point well, and Catherine let it sink in for a moment. Then she asked Nick to continue. He gladly obliged. Okay, we're on item number 3, which is the sales training program. I own that one myself, and we're on pace. I have scheduled a 2-day training session for our salespeople, and I think that all of us should be there too. Mikey seemed incredulous. Why? Because we should all consider ourselves to be salespeople, especially if closing those 18 deals is really our top priority. Catherine left no doubt. It is. Nick continued. Then, we're all going to be involved, and we need to know how to help our sales reps. Nick gave everyone the date of the training, and they wrote it in their calendars. Mikey still seemed peeved. Is there a problem, Mikey? It was Nick who asked. No, no, go ahead. Nick wouldn't accept that. Containing any frustration that he might have felt, he pushed on. No, if you think there's a good reason for you not to be at sales training, then I'm open to hearing it. He paused to see if she would respond, and when she didn't, he continued, Frankly, I can't imagine anything else being more important. Finally, Mikey responded sarcastically, Okay, and I'd like everyone to attend next week's product marketing meeting. Nick restrained himself again. Really? Because if you think we should all be there and it makes sense, then we'll do it. Mikey didn't even consider his offer. Forget it. I'll be at the sales training. I don't need any of you other than Martin at the product marketing meeting. Right at that moment, Catherine became certain that Mikey would have to go. Unfortunately, the next 5 minutes would make that harder than she would have liked. Individual contributor. Nick moved to the 4th item on the list. Okay, how are we doing with product brochures? He directed the question at Mikey. We're all set. Mikey's attempt to avoid being smug was transparent. Nick was a little surprised. Really? Sensing that her peers didn't quite believe her, Mikey reached down into her computer bag, retrieved a stack of glossy leaflets, and began passing them around the room. This is scheduled to go to print next week. The room was quiet as everyone scrutinized the design and read the copy. Catherine could sense that most of them were pleased by the quality of the material, but Nick seemed uncomfortable. Were you going to talk to me about this? Because some of the salespeople are out doing customer research for these brochures, and they're going to be a little miffed when they find out that their input was not... Mikey interrupted. My staff knows this stuff better than anyone else in the company, but if you want to have someone in your department add their 2 cents, that would be fine. It was clear that she didn't think it would be necessary. Nick seemed torn between being impressed by what he was looking at and insulted by the way it was being presented to him. Okay, I'll send you a list of 3 or 4 people who should see this before we go forward. Any excitement about the progress Mikey had made was blunted by her reaction to Nick. Jeff tried to make the awkward situation better. Well, in any case, you and your staff did a great job with this. Mikey enjoyed the compliment a little too much. Well, I've been working hard on it, and it's what I do best. The entire room seemed to groan silently at their colleague's continued lack of humility. In a rare moment of impulsiveness, Catherine decided that she could not wait any longer. After announcing that there would be a long afternoon break until dinner at 6 o'clock, she dismissed everyone, except Mikey. The talk. As soon as everyone had left the room and the door behind them had closed, Catherine felt a sense of remorse and a desire to go for a long walk by herself. How can I get out of this? She wondered, knowing that there was no backing out now. Mikey seemed to have no idea what was about to happen. Catherine couldn't decide if her ignorance would make this easier or harder. She would find out soon enough. This is going to be a tough conversation, Mikey. The marketing vice president briefly flashed a look of realization, then covered it immediately. It is? Catherine took a deep breath and went right to the bone. I don't think you're a fit for this team, and I don't think you really want to be here. Do you know where I'm coming from? A genuine sense of shock hit Mikey, which caught Catherine off guard. She had to see this coming, Catherine moaned to herself. Mikey was incredulous. Me? You've got to be kidding. Of all the people on this team, you think that I... She didn't complete the thought, but stared intently at Catherine. Me? Strangely enough, Catherine was suddenly more comfortable now that the issue was out on the table. She had dealt with enough obliviously difficult executives in her career to stand firm in the midst of their shock, but Mikey was cleverer than the average executive. What's the basis for this? Mikey demanded. Calmly, Catherine explained. Mikey, you don't seem to respect your colleagues. You aren't willing to open up to them. During meetings, you have an extremely distracting and demotivating impact on all of them, including me. As much as Catherine knew that what she said was true, she was suddenly aware of how shallow her accusations might have sounded to someone unfamiliar with the situation. You don't think I respect my colleagues? The problem is they don't respect me. As the words came out of her mouth, Mikey seemed to realize the gravity of her accidental self-indictment. Slightly frazzled, she tried to clarify. They don't appreciate the expertise I have or my experience, and they certainly don't understand how to market software. Catherine listened silently, growing more confident in her decision with every word that Mikey spoke. Sensing this, Mikey attacked, more calmly but with undeniable venom. Catherine, how do you think the board is going to react to my leaving the team? In less than a month, you'll have lost your head of sales and marketing. I'd be pretty worried about my job if I were you. I appreciate your concern, Mikey. Catherine's response had just a touch of sarcasm, but my job is not to avoid confrontation with the board. My job is to build an executive team that can make this company work. She shifted toward a more compassionate tone, and I just don't think you like being part of this one. Mikey now took a breath. Do you really think that taking me off the team is going to help this company? Catherine nodded. Yes, I do, and I honestly believe it will be better for you too. How do you figure that? Catherine decided to be as truthful and kind as possible. Well, you might find a company that appreciates your skills and style more. Catherine wanted to hold back the next sentence, but realized it was in Mikey's best interest to hear it. But I think that might not be easy if you don't take a look at yourself. What does that mean? It means you seem bitter, Mikey, and maybe that's a decision tech thing. Mikey interrupted before Catherine could go any further. It is definitely a decision tech thing because I've never had problems like this before. Catherine was sure this wasn't true, but she decided not to rub salt in her wounds. Then you will definitely be happier somewhere else. Mikey stared at the table in front of her. Catherine sensed that she was coming to terms with the situation, even accepting it. She was wrong. Last stand. Mikey excused herself to collect her thoughts. When she returned a few minutes later, she seemed more emotional and determined than ever. Okay, first of all, I am not resigning. You'll have to fire me. And my husband is a lawyer, so I don't think you'll have an easy time making a case against me. Catherine didn't flinch. But with complete sincerity and sympathy, she responded, I'm not firing you, and you don't have to leave. Mikey seemed confused. Catherine clarified the situation. But your behavior would have to change completely and would have to change fast. Catherine paused to let Mikey consider what she was saying, and frankly, I'm just not sure that you want to go through that. The look on Mikey's face indicated that she definitely didn't want to go through that, but she defended herself nonetheless. I don't think my behavior is the problem around here. Catherine responded, It's certainly not the only one, but it's a very real issue. You don't participate in areas outside your department. You don't accept criticism from your peers or apologize when you're out of line. When have I been out of line? Mikey demanded to know. Catherine couldn't decide whether Mikey was being coy or if she were truly that socially unaware. In either case, she would have to come clean with her, but calmly. I don't know where to start. There's the constant rolling of your eyes. There's the rude and disrespectful remarks, like telling Martin he's an SOB. There's your lack of interest in attending sales training, even though that's the company's top priority. I would say all of those are pretty out of line. Mikey sat in stunned silence. Confronted with such stark evidence, she suddenly seemed to realize the weight of her dilemma. Still, she had a few rounds of ammunition left before she would cede defeat. Listen, I'm sick of hearing people complain about me, and I'm certainly not going to change in order to fit in with this dysfunctional group of people, but I'm not just going to make this easy for you and leave. This is about principle. Catherine remained confident. What principle? Mikey couldn't come up with a specific answer. She just looked at Catherine coldly, shaking her head. Almost a full minute passed. Catherine resisted breaking the silence, wanting Mikey to sit with herself and see the emptiness of her arguments. Finally, Mikey said, I want 3 months' severance, all my stock options vested, and the official record to show that I resigned on my own accord. Relieved, Catherine was more than happy to give Mikey everything she asked for, but she knew better than to say so right there. I'm not sure about all of that, but I'll see if I can make it happen. A few more awkward moments of silence passed. So, You just want me to leave right now? I mean, should I not even stay for dinner? Catherine nodded. You can come get your things at the office next week and meet with HR to work out your exit package, assuming I can get you what you want. You know, you guys are screwed, don't you? Mikey was going to punish Catherine one way or another. I mean, you have no sales or marketing people left, and I wouldn't be surprised if you lost some of my staff members as a result of this. But Catherine had been through this kind of situation plenty of times before, and she'd spent enough time with Mikey's staff to know they saw many of the same flaws in their boss that everyone else did. Still, she felt it would be best to demonstrate some degree of concern. Well, I would certainly understand if that happened, but I hope it's not the case. Mikey shook her head again, as though she were about to launch into another tirade, and then she picked up her computer bag and left. Fleck. Catherine spent the rest of the break taking a long walk around the vineyards. When the meeting resumed, she was refreshed, but completely unprepared for what was about to happen. Before Catherine could raise the subject, Nick asked, "Where's Mikey?" Catherine wanted to deliver the message without seeming too relieved. "Mikey isn't going to be coming back. She's leaving the company." The looks on the faces of the people around the table didn't seem to fit Catherine's expectations. They appeared to be surprised. "How did that happen?" Jan wanted to know. "Well, what I'm about to say needs to be confidential because of legal issues relating to departed employees." Everyone nodded. Catherine was direct. "I didn't see Mikey being willing to adjust her behavior, and it was hurting the team, so I asked her to leave the company." No one spoke. They just looked at one another and at the brochure still sitting on the table in front of them. Finally, Carlos spoke. "Wow, I don't know what to say. How did she take it? What are we going to do about marketing?" Nick continued the list of questions. "What are we going to say to employees, to the press?" As surprised as Catherine was by their response, she quickly summoned an answer. "I don't want to say a lot about how Mikey responded." She was a little surprised, a little angry, neither of which is rare in situations like this. The group waited for Catherine to address the other issues. She continued, "And as far as what we're going to do about marketing, we'll start looking for a new vice president. But we've got plenty of strong people in the organization now who can step up and keep things moving until then. I have no concerns about that." Everyone seemed to digest and agree with Catherine's explanation. "And we'll have to simply tell employees and the press that Mikey is moving on. We don't have a lot of flexibility there in terms of getting into sensitive information. But I don't think we should be intimidated by anyone's initial reactions. If we get our act together and make progress, employees and analysts alike are going to be fine. And I think most people, especially employees, won't be all that surprised." As confident as Catherine was and as logical as her reasoning seemed, the mood in the room remained down. Catherine knew she would have to push them hard to focus on real work. She didn't realize how much more work she had to do to put the Mikey issue to rest. Heavy lifting. For the rest of the evening and into the next afternoon, the group focused on the details of the business, with special attention on sales. Though they certainly made progress, Catherine couldn't deny that Mikey's departure was continuing to dampen the general atmosphere. She decided to enter the danger. When lunch was over, Catherine addressed the group. "I'd like to take a few minutes to deal with the elephant that's sitting in the corner. I want to know how everyone is feeling about Mikey leaving, because we need to make sure that we deal with this as a team before I stand in front of the company and explain it to them next week." Though it always amazed her, Catherine knew from past experience that the departure of even the most difficult employees provoked some degree of mourning and self-doubt among their peers. Team members looked around at one another to see who would go first. It was Nick. "I guess I'm just worried about losing another member of the executive team." Catherine nodded to acknowledge his concern, but really wanted to say, "But she was never a member of this team." Jan added, "I know she was a difficult person, but the quality of her work was good, and marketing is critical right now. Maybe we should have just tolerated her." Catherine nodded to indicate that she was listening. "Anyone else?" Martin sort of raised his hand, making it clear that he was about to make a statement that he didn't want to make. "I guess I'm just wondering who's next." Catherine paused before responding. "Let me tell you a quick story about myself, one that I'm not too proud of." That got everyone's attention. Catherine frowned, as if she didn't really want to do what she was about to do. "When I was in my last quarter of graduate school, I took a job as a contractor at a well-known retail company in San Francisco, where I ran a small department of financial analysts. It was my first real management position, and I was hoping to land a permanent job with the company after graduation. In spite of her limitations as a public speaker, Catherine had a knack for telling stories. I inherited a pretty good group of people. They all worked hard, but one guy in particular cranked out more reports and better ones than anyone else. I'll call him Fred. Fred took any assignment I gave him and became my most reliable employee. Sounds like a problem I'd like to have, Nick commented. Catherine raised her eyebrows. Well, there's more to the story. No one else in the department could stand Fred. And to be honest, he annoyed the heck out of me, too. He didn't help anyone with their work, and he made sure everyone knew how much better he was at his job, which was undeniable, even to the people who hated the guy. Anyway, my staff came to me a number of times, complaining about Fred. I listened carefully and even spoke to Fred half-heartedly about adjusting his behavior, but I mostly ignored them because I could tell that they resented his skills. More importantly, I was not about to come down on my top performer. The staff seemed to empathize with her. Catherine went on. Eventually, the output of the department began to slide, and so I gave more work to Fred, who complained a little but managed to get it all done. In my mind, he was carrying the department. Pretty soon, morale in the department began to deteriorate more rapidly than ever, and our performance slid further. Again, a number of analysts came to me to complain about Fred, and it was becoming clear that he was indeed contributing to the problems of the group more than I had thought. After a tough night of thinking and losing sleep, I made my first big decision. Jeff Guest, you fired him. Catherine smiled in a shameful kind of way. No, I promoted him. Jaws around the table dropped. Catherine nodded her head. That's right. Fred was my first promotion as a manager. 2 weeks later, 3 of my 7 analysts quit, and the department fell into chaos. We dropped way behind in our work, and my manager called me in to talk about what was going on. I explained the Fred situation and why I had lost the other analysts. The next day, he made a big decision. Jeff guessed again. He fired him. Catherine smiled in a painfully humorous way. Close. He fired me. The staff seemed surprised. Jan wanted to make her feel better, but companies don't usually fire contractors. Catherine was suddenly a little sarcastic. Okay, let's just say that the assignment ended abruptly and they never bothered to have me back. Nick and Martin smiled, trying not to crack up. Catherine completed their thoughts. I definitely got fired. Everyone in the room laughed. What happened to Fred? Jeff wanted to know. I hear that he quit a few weeks later, and they hired someone else to run the department. Performance improved dramatically within a month of his departure, even though the department now had 3 fewer analysts than before. Are you saying that Fred's behavior alone hurt the production of the group by 50%? No, not Fred's behavior. People seemed confused. My tolerance of his behavior. Listen, they fired the right person. No one spoke. They seemed to be feeling their boss's pain and making the obvious connection between Catherine's story and what had happened the day before. After a few moments, Catherine brought her lesson home. I don't plan on losing any of you, and that's why I did what I did. At that moment, everyone in the room seemed to understand her. Rally. Back at the office, Catherine held an all-hands meeting to discuss Mikey's departure and other company issues. In spite of her typically tactful and gracious demeanor, the news provoked more concern among employees than the executives had expected. And though they agreed that the reaction had more to do with its symbolic meaning than with losing Mikey in particular, it dampened the enthusiasm of the team. So, during the next staff meeting, Catherine had the group spend more than an hour discussing how they were going to replace their head of marketing. After a heated debate about whether to promote one of Mikey's direct reports, Catherine stepped in to break the tie. All right, this has been a good discussion, and I think I've heard everyone. Does anyone have anything else to add? No one spoke, so Catherine continued. I believe that we need to find someone who can grow the department and help us with branding. And as much as I would prefer to promote someone internally, I don't see anyone in the department who is close to being able to do that right now. And so I think we should begin a search for a new vice president. Every head in the room nodded support, even those who had argued against an outside hire. But I can assure you that we're going to find the right person. That means everyone here will be interviewing candidates and pushing to find someone who can demonstrate trust, engage in conflict, commit to group decisions, hold their peers accountable, and focus on the results of the team, not their own ego. Catherine was certain that her staff had begun to buy into her theory. After asking Jeff to organize a search for the new VP, she shifted the topic to sales. Nick reported that progress had been made with a few key prospects and that some regions of the country were still struggling. "I think we need more feet on the street." Jan knew that Nick was asking for more money and tried to put a quick halt to his thinking. "I don't want to add more expenses because that only means your quotas will go up. We don't want to get into a death spiral here." Nick breathed hard and shook his head in exasperation, as if to say, "There you go again." Before anyone knew what was going on, Nick and Jan were pounding on the table, trying to convince one another and the rest of the group that their approach was right. During a brief pause in the action, Jan threw herself back in her chair in frustration and proclaimed, "Nothing around here has changed. Maybe the problem wasn't Mikey after all." That sobered the group. Catherine jumped in, smiling. "Hold on, hold on. I don't see anything wrong here. This is the kind of conflict we've been talking about for the past month. It's perfect." Jan tried to explain herself. "I guess I just don't see it that way. It still feels like we're fighting." "You are fighting, but about issues. That's your job. Otherwise, you leave it to your people to try to solve problems that they can't solve. They want you to hash this stuff out so they can get clear direction from us." Jan seemed tired. "I hope this is worth it." Catherine smiled again. "Trust me, it will be worth it in more ways than you know." Over the next 2 weeks, Catherine began to push her team harder than ever before around their behavior. She chided Martin for eroding trust by appearing smug during meetings. She forced Carlos to confront the team about their lack of responsiveness to customer issues. And she spent more than one late night with Jan and Nick, working through budget battles that had to be fought. More important than what Catherine did, however, was the reaction she received. As resistant as they might have seemed in the moment, no one questioned whether they should be doing the things that Catherine made them do. There seemed to be a genuine sense of collective purpose. The only question that remained in Catherine's mind was whether she could keep it going long enough for everyone to see the benefits. Part 4. Traction. Harvest. Although the last of Catherine's Napa Valley offsites had a different atmosphere from the others, it began with a familiar speech. "We have a more experienced set of executives than any of our competitors. We have more cash than they do. Thanks to Martin and his team, we have better core technology, and we have a more connected board of directors. Yet, in spite of all of that, we are behind two of our competitors in terms of both revenue and customer growth, and I think we all know why that is." Nick raised his hand. "Catherine, I'd like you to stop giving that speech." A month earlier, everyone in the room would have been shocked by such a blunt statement, but no one seemed to be alarmed at all. "Why is that?" Catherine asked. Nick frowned, trying to think of the right words. "I guess it seemed more appropriate a few weeks ago when we were a lot more..." Nick didn't need to finish the sentence. Catherine explained as nicely as she could. "I'll stop making this speech when it's no longer true. We're still behind two of our competitors, and we are still not where we need to be as a team." Catherine continued, "But that's not to say that we aren't on the right track. In fact, the first thing we're going to do today is take a step back and assess where we are as a team." Catherine went to the whiteboard and drew the triangle again, filling in the five dysfunctions. Then she asked, "How are we doing?" The team considered the question as they re-examined the model. Finally, Jeff spoke first. "We certainly trust each other more than we did a month ago." Heads around the room nodded, and Jeff completed the thought. "Although I think that it's still too early to say that there isn't more work to be done." Heads continued to nod. Jan added, "And we're doing better with conflict, although I can't say I'm used to it yet." Catherine assured her, "I don't think anyone ever gets completely used to conflict. If it's not a little uncomfortable, then it's not real. The key is to keep doing it anyway." Jan accepted the explanation. Nick jumped in. "As far as commitment is concerned, we have definitely started getting better buy-in around objectives and deliverables. That's not a problem. But the next one, accountability, worries me the most." "Why?" asked Jeff. "Because I'm not sure that we're going to be willing to get in each other's faces when someone doesn't deliver or if someone starts acting against the good of the team." "I'm certainly going to get in their face." To everyone's surprise, it was Martin who made the comment. He explained, "I don't think I could handle going back to the way things were before, and so, if it comes down to a little interpersonal discomfort versus politics, I'm opting for the discomfort." Nick smiled at his quirky colleague and finished the model. "Well, I don't think we're going to have a results problem. None of us will come out of this smelling rosy if we can't make this company work." Catherine had never been so glad to see a room full of people nod their heads in agreement, but she decided that she would let some of the air out of the team's balloon. "Listen, I agree with most of what you said about the team. You're moving in the right direction. But I want to assure you that there will be many days during the next few months when you will wonder if you've made any progress at all. It's going to take more than a few weeks of behavioral change before we see a tangible impact on the bottom line." The team seemed to be agreeing with her too easily. She decided she'd need to rattle them one more time. "I'm telling you this because we're not out of the woods yet. I've seen plenty of groups slide backward that were a lot further along than we are. This is about having the discipline and persistence to keep doing what we're doing." As bad as Catherine felt about raining on the team's parade, she was relieved to have prepared them for the bad weather every team faces on the way to shedding their dysfunctions. And for the next 2 days, the team experienced that weather. At times, working together in a spirit of cooperation, at other times, seemingly at each other's throats, the group wrestled with business issues and worked each one through to resolution. Ironically, they rarely discussed the notion of teamwork directly, which Catherine interpreted as a sign that they were making progress. Two observations that Catherine made during breaks and meals told her she was right. First, the team seemed to stay together, choosing not to go off on their own as they had at previous off-sites. Second, they were noisier than they had ever been, and one of the most prevalent sounds that could be heard among them was laughter. By the end of the session, though they were clearly exhausted, everyone seemed eager to schedule follow-up meetings with one another when they returned to the office. Gut check. 3 months after the final off-site had ended, Catherine held her first quarterly 2-day staff meeting at a local hotel. The new vice president of marketing, Joseph Charles, had joined Decision Tech a week earlier and was attending his first meeting with the group. Catherine kicked off the session by making an announcement that no one was prepared for. "Remember Green Banana, the company that we considered buying last quarter?" Heads around the table nodded. "Well, evidently Nick was right about there being a possible competitor. They want to buy us." Everyone, except Jeff, who sat on the board and already knew about the offer, was shocked. No one more so than Nick. "I thought they were in financial trouble." "They were," explained Catherine. "I guess they raised a truckload of money last month and are suddenly hungry to buy something. They've already made us an offer." "What's it look like?" Jan wanted to know. Catherine looked at her notes. "Quite a bit more than our estimated worth today. We would all make decent money." Jan pressed on. "What did the board say?" Jeff answered for Catherine. "They're leaving it up to us." No one spoke. It was as if they were all calculating their potential payouts and trying to put the offer into some sort of context. Finally, an almost angry voice with a British accent broke the silence. "No bloody way!" Everyone turned toward their head of engineering. He spoke with more passion than anyone had ever heard from him. "There is no way that I'm going to walk away from all of this and hand it over to a company named after a piece of unripened fruit!" The group burst into laughter. Jan brought them back down to earth. "I don't think we should discard this quite so fast. There's no guarantee that we're going to make it. This is real money." Jeff added to his CFO's point. "The board certainly doesn't think it's a bad offer." Martin didn't seem to believe Jeff.
"Then why did he leave it to us to make the decision?"
Jeff paused for a moment before explaining. "Because they want to know that we have the fire in our bellies." Martin frowned.
"The what?"
Jeff clarified for his British colleague. "They want to know if we want to be here, if we're really committed to the company and to each other." Joseph summarized the situation. "Sounds like this is a gut check." Carlos spoke for the first time during the meeting. "I vote against it." Jeff was next. "So do I, definitely." Nick nodded his head, as did Catherine and Joseph. Martin looked at Jan.
"What do you say?"
She hesitated for a moment.
"Green Banana? Are you kidding?"
They broke into laughter. Catherine quickly refocused the meeting, wanting to capture the momentum and direct it toward real business. "Okay, we've got plenty of other big topics to take care of today, so let's get started." For the next several hours, the group took Joseph through the 5 dysfunctions. Nick explained the importance of trust. Jan and Jeff together covered conflict and commitment. Carlos described accountability within the context of the team, and Martin finished off results. They then reviewed Joseph's Myers-Briggs results and explained the roles and responsibilities of his new peers, as well as their collective goals. Most importantly, for the rest of the day, they launched into some of the most passionate debates Joseph had ever heard and ended those debates with crystal-clear agreements and no sense of lingering bitterness. They called each other on the carpet once or twice in ways that made Joseph uncomfortable, but in each case, they brought the discussions around to results. By the end of the session, Joseph decided he had joined one of the most unusual and intense executive teams he had ever seen, and he couldn't wait to become an active part of it. The March. Over the course of the next year, Decision Tech grew its sales dramatically and met its revenue goals during three of its four quarters. The company moved into a virtual tie for the number one position in the industry, but had yet to separate itself from its chief rival. With the substantial improvement in performance, the company saw turnover among employees subside and morale rise steadily, with the exception of a slight and temporary dip when the company missed its numbers. Interestingly, when that happened, even the chairman called to encourage Catherine not to get too disappointed in light of the undeniable progress she had made. With more than 250 employees, Catherine decided it was time to trim down the number of executives who reported directly to her. She believed that the larger the company, the smaller the team should be at the top. And with the addition of a new head of sales and a human resources director, her staff had grown to a barely manageable 8. It wasn't that Catherine couldn't handle the weekly one-on-ones, but it was increasingly difficult to have fluid and substantive discussions during staff meetings with 9 people sitting around the table. Even with the new collective attitude of the members of the team, it would be only a matter of time before problems began to surface. So, more than a year after the final Napa offsite had ended, Catherine decided to make a few organizational changes, which she delicately but confidently explained to each of her staff members. Nick would again assume the role of Chief Operating Officer, a title he finally felt he had earned. Carlos and the new head of sales would report to him and would no longer be on the CEO's staff. Human Resources would report to Jan, leaving Catherine with 5 direct reports: Martin as CTO, Jan as CFO, Nick as COO, Joseph as VP of Marketing, and Jeff as VP of Business Development. A week later, another of Catherine's quarterly 2-day staff meetings took place. Before Catherine could start the meeting, Jan wanted to know, "Where's Jeff?" Catherine responded matter-of-factly, "That's what I wanted to talk about first today. Jeff won't be coming to these meetings anymore." The room was stunned, both at what Catherine had said and that she said it with so little emotion. Finally, Jan asked the question that everyone was thinking. "Jeff quit?" Catherine seemed a little surprised by the question. "No." Martin then followed, "You didn't fire him, did you?" Suddenly, it occurred to Catherine what everyone was thinking. "No, of course not. Why would I fire Jeff? It's just that he'll be reporting to Nick from now on. Given his new role, he and I both agreed that it makes a lot of sense." As much as everyone was relieved that their worst fears had been allayed, there was still something bothering them. Jan couldn't hold back. "Catherine, I can certainly see that it makes sense, and frankly, I'm sure that Nick is glad to have Jeff on his team." Nick nodded to confirm this, and Jan continued, "But don't you think he's disappointed about not reporting directly to you anymore? I mean, I know we're not supposed to be concerned with status and ego and all of that, but he is a board member and a founder. Did you really consider what this means to him?" Catherine smiled proudly, delighted that they had forced her to explain what she had been wanting to tell them all along. "You guys, this was Jeff's idea." That thought had not occurred to any of them. Catherine went on. "He said that as much as he wanted to stay on the team, it made more sense for him to be part of Nick's group. I actually gave him a chance to change his mind, and he insisted it was the right thing to do for the company and for the team." Catherine let her team enjoy a silent moment of admiration for their former CEO. And then she continued, "I think we owe it to Jeff and everyone else at this company to make this work. Let's get started." The model. As difficult as it is to build a cohesive team, it is not complicated. In fact, keeping it simple is critical, whether you run the executive staff at a multinational company, a small department within a larger organization, or even if you are merely a member of a team that needs improvement. In that spirit, this section is designed to provide a clear, concise, and practical guide to using the 5 dysfunctions model to improve your team. Good luck. An overview of the model. In the course of my experience working with CEOs and their teams, 2 critical truths have become clear to me. First, genuine teamwork in most organizations remains as elusive as it has ever been. Second, organizations fail to achieve teamwork because they unknowingly fall prey to 5 natural but dangerous pitfalls, which I call the 5 dysfunctions of a team. These dysfunctions can be mistakenly interpreted as 5 distinct issues that can be addressed in isolation of the others. but in reality, they form an interrelated model, making susceptibility to even one of them potentially lethal for the success of a team. A cursory overview of each dysfunction and the model they comprise should make this clearer. Number one, the first dysfunction is an absence of trust among team members. Essentially, this stems from their unwillingness to be vulnerable within the group. Team members who are not genuinely open with one another about their mistakes and weaknesses make it impossible to build a foundation for trust. Number two, this failure to build trust is damaging because it sets the tone for the second dysfunction, fear of conflict. Teams that lack trust are incapable of engaging in unfiltered and passionate debate of ideas. Instead, they resort to veiled discussions and guarded comments. Number three, a lack of healthy conflict is a problem because it ensures the third dysfunction of a team, lack of commitment. Without having aired their opinions in the course of passionate and open debate, team members rarely, if ever, buy in and commit to decisions, though they may feign agreement during meetings. Number four, because of this lack of real commitment and buy-in, team members develop an avoidance of accountability, the fourth dysfunction. Without committing to a clear plan of action, even the most focused and driven people often hesitate to call their peers on actions and behaviors that seem counterproductive to the good of the team. Number five, failure to hold one another accountable creates an environment where the fifth dysfunction can thrive. Inattention to results occurs when team members put their individual needs, such as ego, career development, or recognition, or even the needs of their divisions, above the collective goals of the team. And so, like a chain with just one link broken, teamwork deteriorates even if a single dysfunction is allowed to flourish. Another way to understand this model is to take the opposite approach, a positive one, and imagine how members of truly cohesive teams behave. Number one, they trust one another. Number two, they engage in unfiltered conflict around ideas. Number three, they commit to decisions and plans of action. Number four, they hold one another accountable for delivering against those plans. Number five, they focus on the achievement of collective results. If this sounds simple, it's because it is simple, at least in theory. In practice, however, it is extremely difficult because it requires levels of discipline and persistence that few teams can muster. Before diving into each of the dysfunctions and exploring ways to overcome them, it might be helpful to assess your team and identify where the opportunities for improvement lie in your organization. Understanding and overcoming the five dysfunctions. Dysfunction 1, absence of trust. Trust lies at the heart of a functioning, cohesive team. Without it, teamwork is all but impossible. Unfortunately, the word trust is used and misused so often that it has lost some of its impact and begins to sound like motherhood and apple pie. That is why it is important to be very specific about what is meant by trust. In the context of building a team, trust is the confidence among team members that their peers' intentions are good and that there is no reason to be protective or careful around the group. In essence, teammates must get comfortable being vulnerable with one another. This description stands in contrast to a more standard definition of trust, one that centers around the ability to predict a person's behavior based on past experience. For instance, one might trust that a given teammate will produce high-quality work because he has always done so in the past. As desirable as this may be, it is not enough to represent the kind of trust that is characteristic of a great team. It requires team members to make themselves vulnerable to one another and be confident that their respective vulnerabilities will not be used against them. The vulnerabilities I'm referring to include weaknesses, skill deficiencies, interpersonal shortcomings, mistakes, and requests for help. As soft as all of this might sound, it's only when team members are truly comfortable being exposed to one another that they begin to act without concern for protecting themselves. As a result, they can focus their energy and attention completely on the job at hand, rather than on being strategically disingenuous or political with one another. Achieving vulnerability-based trust is difficult because in the course of career advancement and education, most successful people learn to be competitive with their peers and protective of their reputations. It is a challenge for them to turn those instincts off for the good of a team, but that is exactly what is required. The costs of failing to do this are great. Teams that lack trust waste inordinate amounts of time and energy managing their behaviors and interactions within the group. They tend to dread team meetings and are reluctant to take risks in asking for or offering assistance to others. As a result, morale on distrusting teams is usually quite low and unwanted turnover is high. Suggestions for overcoming dysfunction 1. How does a team go about building trust? Unfortunately, vulnerability-based trust cannot be achieved overnight. It requires shared experiences over time, multiple instances of follow-through and credibility, and an in-depth understanding of the unique attributes of team members. However, by taking a focused approach, a team can dramatically accelerate the process and achieve trust in relatively short order. Here are a few tools that can bring this about. Personal histories exercise. In less than an hour, a team can take the first steps toward developing trust. This low-risk exercise requires nothing more than going around the table during a meeting and having team members answer a short list of questions about themselves. Questions need not be overly sensitive in nature and might include the following: number of siblings, hometown, unique challenges of childhood, favorite hobbies, first job, and worst job. Simply by describing these relatively innocuous attributes or experiences, team members begin to relate to one another on a more personal basis and see one another as human beings with life stories and interesting backgrounds. This encourages greater empathy and understanding and discourages unfair and inaccurate behavioral attributions. It is amazing how little some team members know about one another and how just a small amount of information begins to break down barriers. Minimum time required, 30 minutes. Team effectiveness exercise. This exercise is more rigorous and relevant than the previous one, but may involve more risk. It requires team members to identify the single most important contribution that each of their peers makes to the team, as well as the one area that they must either improve upon or eliminate for the good of the team. All members then report their responses, focusing on one person at a time, usually beginning with the team leader. While this exercise may seem somewhat intrusive and dangerous at first glance, it is remarkable how manageable it can be and how much useful information, both constructive and positive, can be extracted in about an hour. And though the team effectiveness exercise certainly requires some degree of trust in order to be useful, even a relatively dysfunctional team can often make it work with surprisingly little tension. Minimum time required, 60 minutes. Personality and behavioral preference profiles. Some of the most effective and lasting tools for building trust on a team are profiles of team members' behavioral preferences and personality styles. These help break down barriers by allowing people to better understand and empathize with one another. The best profiling tool, in my opinion, is the Myers-Briggs Type Indicator, MBTI. However, a number of others are popular among different audiences. The purpose of most of these tools is to provide practical and scientifically valid behavioral descriptions of various team members according to the diverse ways that they think, speak, and act. Some of the best characteristics of tools like the MBTI are their non-judgmental nature. No type is better than another, although they differ substantially. Their basis in research, they are not founded upon astrology or New Age science, and the extent to which participants take an active role in identifying their own types. They don't simply receive a computer printout or test score that alone dictates their type. Many of these tools do require the participation of a licensed consultant, which is important to avoid the misuse of their powerful implications and applications. Minimum time required, 4 hours. 360-degree feedback. These tools have become popular over the past 20 years and can produce powerful results for a team. They are riskier than any of the tools or exercises described so far because they call for peers to make specific judgments and provide one another with constructive criticism. The key to making a 360-degree program work, in my opinion, is divorcing it entirely from compensation and formal performance evaluation. Rather, it should be used as a developmental tool, one that allows employees to identify strengths and weaknesses without any repercussions. By being even slightly connected to formal performance evaluation or compensation, 360-degree programs can take on dangerous political undertones. Experiential team exercises. Ropes courses and other experiential team activities seem to have lost some of their luster over the course of the past 10 years, and deservedly so. Still, many teams do them with the hope of building trust. And while there are certainly some benefits derived from rigorous and creative outdoor activities involving collective support and cooperation, those benefits do not always translate directly to the working world. That being said, experiential team exercises can be valuable tools for enhancing teamwork as long as they're layered upon more fundamental and relevant processes. While each of these tools and exercises can have a significant short-term impact on a team's ability to build trust, they must be accompanied by regular follow-up in the course of daily work. Individual development areas must be revisited to ensure that progress does not lose momentum. Even on a strong team, and perhaps especially so, atrophy can lead to the erosion of trust. The role of the leader. The most important action that a leader must take to encourage the building of trust on a team is to demonstrate vulnerability first. This requires that a leader risk losing face in front of the team so that subordinates will take the same risk themselves. What is more, team leaders must create an environment that does not punish vulnerability. Even well-intentioned teams can subtly discourage trust by chastising one another for admissions of weakness or failure. Finally, displays of vulnerability on the part of a team leader must be genuine. They cannot be staged. One of the best ways to lose the trust of a team is to feign vulnerability in order to manipulate the emotions of others. Connection to dysfunction 2. How does all of this relate to the next dysfunction, the fear of conflict? By building trust, a team makes conflict possible because team members do not hesitate to engage in passionate and sometimes emotional debate, knowing that they will not be punished for saying something that might otherwise be interpreted as destructive or critical. Dysfunction 2. Fear of conflict. All great relationships, the ones that last over time, require productive conflict in order to grow. This is true in marriage, parenthood, friendship, and certainly business. Unfortunately, conflict is considered taboo in many situations, especially at work. And the higher you go up the management chain, the more you find people spending inordinate amounts of time and energy trying to avoid the kind of passionate debates that are essential to any great team. It is important to distinguish productive ideological conflict from destructive fighting and interpersonal politics. Ideological conflict is limited to concepts and ideas and avoids personality-focused, mean-spirited attacks. However, it can have many of the same external qualities of interpersonal conflict, passion, emotion, and frustration, so much so that an outside observer might easily mistake it for unproductive discord. But teams that engage in productive conflict know that the only purpose is to produce the best possible solution in the shortest period of time. They discuss and resolve issues more quickly and completely than others, and they emerge from heated debates with no residual feelings or collateral damage, but with an eagerness and readiness to take on the next important issue. Ironically, teams that avoid ideological conflict often do so in order to avoid hurting team members' feelings, and then end up encouraging dangerous tension. When team members do not openly debate and disagree about important ideas, they often turn to back-channel personal attacks, which are far nastier and more harmful than any heated argument over issues. It is also ironic that so many people avoid conflict in the name of efficiency, because healthy conflict is actually a time-saver. Contrary to the notion that teams waste time and energy arguing, those that avoid conflict actually doom themselves to revisiting issues again and again without resolution. They often ask team members to take their issues offline, which seems to be a euphemism for avoiding dealing with an important topic, only to have it raised again at the next meeting. Suggestions for overcoming dysfunction 2. How does a team go about developing the ability and willingness to engage in healthy conflict? The first step is acknowledging that conflict is productive and that many teams have a tendency to avoid it. As long as some team members believe that conflict is unnecessary, there is little chance that it will occur. But beyond mere recognition, there are a few simple methods for making conflict more common and productive. Mining. Members of teams that tend to avoid conflict must occasionally assume the role of miner of conflict, Someone who extracts buried disagreements within the team and sheds the light of day on them. They must have the courage and confidence to call out sensitive issues and force team members to work through them. This requires a degree of objectivity during meetings and a commitment to staying with the conflict until it is resolved. Some teams may want to assign a member of the team to take on this responsibility during a given meeting or discussion. Real-time permission. In the process of mining for conflict, the team members need to coach one another not to retreat from healthy debate. One simple but effective way to do this is to recognize when the people engaged in conflict are becoming uncomfortable with the level of discord, and then interrupt to remind them that what they are doing is necessary. As simple and paternal as this may sound, it is a remarkably effective tool for draining tension from a productive but difficult interchange, giving the participants the confidence to continue. And once the discussion or meeting has ended, it is helpful to remind participants that the conflict they just engaged in is good for the team and not something to avoid in the future. Other tools. As mentioned earlier in this section, there are a variety of personality style and behavioral preference tools that allow team members to better understand one another. Because most of these include descriptions of how different types deal with conflict, they can be useful for helping people anticipate their approach or resistance to it. Another tool that specifically relates to conflict is the Thomas Kilman Conflict Mode Instrument, commonly referred to as the TKI. It allows team members to understand natural inclinations around conflict so they can make more strategic choices about which approaches are most appropriate in different situations. The role of the leader. One of the most difficult challenges that a leader faces in promoting healthy conflict is the desire to protect members from harm. This leads to premature interruption of disagreements and prevents team members from developing coping skills for dealing with conflict themselves. This is not unlike parents who overprotect their children from quarrels or altercations with siblings. In many cases, it serves only to strain the relationships by depriving the participants of an opportunity to develop conflict management skills. It also leaves them hungry for resolution that never occurs. Therefore, it is key that leaders demonstrate restraint when their people engage in conflict and allow resolution to occur naturally, as messy as it can sometimes be. This can be a challenge because many leaders feel that they are somehow failing in their jobs by losing control of their teams during conflict. Finally, as trite as it may sound, a leader's ability to personally model appropriate conflict behavior is essential. By avoiding conflict when it is necessary and productive, something many executives do, a team leader will encourage this dysfunction to thrive. Connection to dysfunction 3. How does all of this relate to the next dysfunction, the lack of commitment? By engaging in productive conflict and tapping into team members' perspectives and opinions, a team can confidently commit and buy into a decision knowing that they have benefited from everyone's ideas. Dysfunction 3, lack of commitment. In the context of a team, commitment is a function of two things, clarity and buy-in. Great teams make clear and timely decisions and move forward with complete buy-in from every member of the team, even those who voted against the decision. They leave meetings confident that no one on the team is quietly harboring doubts about whether to support the actions agreed on. The two greatest causes of the lack of commitment are the desire for consensus and the need for certainty. Consensus. Great teams understand the danger of seeking consensus and find ways to achieve buy-in even when complete agreement is impossible. They understand that reasonable human beings do not need to get their way in order to support a decision, but only need to know that their opinions have been heard and considered. Great teams ensure that everyone's ideas are genuinely considered, which then creates a willingness to rally around whatever decision is ultimately made by the group. And when that is not possible due to an impasse, the leader of the team is allowed to make the call. Certainty. Great teams also pride themselves on being able to unite behind decisions and commit to clear courses of action even when there is little assurance about whether the decision is correct. That's because they understand the old military axiom that a decision is better than no decision. They also realize that it is better to make a decision boldly and be wrong, and then change direction with equal boldness, than it is to waffle. Contrast this with the behavior of dysfunctional teams that try to hedge their bets and delay important decisions until they have enough data to feel certain that they are making the right decision. As prudent as this might seem, it is dangerous because of the paralysis and lack of confidence it breeds within a team. It is important to remember that conflict underlies the willingness to commit without perfect information. In many cases, teams have all the information they need, but it resides within the hearts and minds of the team itself and must be extracted through unfiltered debate. Only when everyone has put their opinions and perspectives on the table can the team confidently commit to a decision, knowing that it has tapped into the collective wisdom of the entire group. Regardless of whether it is caused by the need for consensus or certainty, it's important to understand that one of the greatest consequences for an executive team that does not commit to clear decisions is unresolvable discord deeper in the organization. More than any of the dysfunctions, this one creates dangerous ripple effects for subordinates. When an executive team fails to achieve buy-in from all team members, even if the disparities that exist may seem relatively small, employees who report to those executives will inevitably clash when they try to interpret marching orders that are not clearly aligned with those of the colleagues in other departments. Like a vortex, small gaps between executives high up in an organization become major discrepancies by the time they reach employees below. Suggestions for overcoming dysfunction 3. How does a team go about ensuring commitment? By taking specific steps to maximize clarity and achieve buy-in, and resisting the lure of consensus or certainty, here are a few simple but effective tools and principles. Cascading messaging. One of the most valuable disciplines that any team can adopt takes just a few minutes and is absolutely free. At the end of a staff meeting or offsite, a team should explicitly review the key decisions made during the meeting and agree on what needs to be communicated to employees or other constituencies about those decisions. What often happens during this exercise is that members of the team learn that they are not all on the same page about what has been agreed upon and that they need to clarify specific outcomes before putting them into action. Moreover, they become clear on which of the decisions should remain confidential and which must be communicated quickly and comprehensively. Finally, by leaving meetings clearly aligned with one another, leaders send a powerful and welcomed message to employees who have grown accustomed to receiving inconsistent and even contradictory statements from managers who attended the same meeting. Minimum time required, 10 minutes. Deadlines. As simple as it seems, one of the best tools for ensuring commitment is the use of clear deadlines for when decisions will be made and honoring those dates with discipline and rigidity. The worst enemy of a team that is susceptible to this dysfunction is ambiguity, and timing is one of the most critical factors that must be made clear. What is more, committing to deadlines for intermediate decisions and milestones is just as important as final deadlines, because it ensures that misalignment among team members is identified and addressed before the costs are too great. Contingency and worst-case scenario analysis. A team that struggles with commitment can begin overcoming this tendency by briefly discussing contingency plans upfront, or better yet, clarifying the worst-case scenario for a decision they are struggling to make. This usually allows them to reduce their fears by helping them realize that the costs of an incorrect decision are survivable and far less damaging than they had imagined. Low-risk exposure therapy. Another relevant exercise for a commitment-phobic team is the demonstration of decisiveness in relatively low-risk situations. When teams force themselves to make decisions after substantial discussion but little analysis or research, they usually come to realize that the quality of the decision they made was better than they had expected. What is more, they learn that the decision would not have been much different had the team engaged in lengthy, time-consuming study. This is not to say that research and analysis are not necessary or important, but rather that teams with this dysfunction tend to overvalue them. The role of the leader. More than any other member of the team, the leader must be comfortable with the prospect of making a decision that ultimately turns out to be wrong. And the leader must be constantly pushing the group for closure around issues, as well as adherence to schedules that the team has set. What the leader cannot do is place too high a premium on certainty or consensus. Connection to dysfunction 4. How does all of this relate to the next dysfunction, the avoidance of accountability? In order for teammates to call each other on their behaviors and actions, they must have a clear sense of what is expected. Even the most ardent believers in accountability usually balk at having to hold someone accountable for something that was never bought into or made clear in the first place. Dysfunction 4, avoidance of accountability. Accountability is a buzzword that has lost much of its meaning as it has become as overused as terms like empowerment and quality. In the context of teamwork, however, it refers specifically to the willingness of team members to call their peers on performance or behaviors that might hurt the team. The essence of this dysfunction is the unwillingness of team members to tolerate the interpersonal discomfort that accompanies calling a peer on his or her behavior and the more general tendency to avoid difficult conversations. Members of great teams overcome these natural inclinations, opting instead to enter the danger with one another. Of course, this is easier said than done, even among cohesive teams with strong personal relationships. In fact, team members who are particularly close to one another sometimes hesitate to hold one another accountable precisely because they fear jeopardizing a valuable personal relationship. Ironically, this only causes the relationship to deteriorate as team members begin to resent one another for not living up to expectations and for allowing the standards of the group to erode. Members of great teams improve their relationships by holding one another accountable, thus demonstrating that they respect each other and have high expectations for one another's performance. As politically incorrect as it sounds, the most effective and efficient means of maintaining high standards of performance on a team is peer pressure. One of the benefits is the reduction of the need for excessive bureaucracy around performance management and corrective action. More than any policy or system, there is nothing like the fear of letting down respected teammates that motivates people to improve their performance. Suggestions for overcoming dysfunction 4. How does a team go about ensuring accountability? The key to overcoming this dysfunction is adhering to a few classic management tools that are as effective as they are simple. Publication of goals and standards. A good way to make it easier for team members to hold one another accountable is to clarify publicly exactly what the team needs to achieve, who needs to deliver what, and how everyone must behave in order to succeed. The enemy of accountability is ambiguity. And even when a team has initially committed to a plan or a set of behavioral standards, it is important to keep those agreements in the open so that no one can easily ignore them. Simple and regular progress reviews. A little structure goes a long way toward helping people take action that they might not otherwise be inclined to do. This is especially true when it comes to giving people feedback on their behavior or performance. Team members should regularly communicate with one another, either verbally or in written form, about how they feel their teammates are doing against stated objectives and standards. Relying on them to do so on their own, with no clear expectations or structure, is inviting the potential for the avoidance of accountability. Team rewards. By shifting rewards away from individual performance to team achievement, the team can create a culture of accountability. This occurs because a team is unlikely to stand by quietly and fail because a peer is not pulling his or her weight. The role of the leader. One of the most difficult challenges for a leader who wants to instill accountability on a team is to encourage and allow the team to serve as the first and primary accountability mechanism. Sometimes, strong leaders naturally create an accountability vacuum within the team, leaving themselves as the only source of discipline. This creates an environment where team members assume that the leader is holding others accountable, and so they hold back even when they see something that isn't right. Once a leader has created a culture of accountability on a team, however, he or she must be willing to serve as the ultimate arbiter of discipline when the team itself fails. This should be a rare occurrence. Nevertheless, it must be clear to all team members that accountability has not been relegated to a consensus approach, but merely to a shared team responsibility, and that the leader of the team will not hesitate to step in when it is necessary. Connection to dysfunction 5. How does all of this relate to the next dysfunction, the inattention to results? If teammates are not being held accountable for their contributions, they will be more likely to turn their attention to their own needs and to the advancement of themselves or their departments. An absence of accountability is an invitation to team members to shift their attention to areas other than collective results. Dysfunction 5, inattention to results. The ultimate dysfunction of a team is the tendency of members to care about something other than the collective goals of the group. An unrelenting focus on specific objectives and clearly defined outcomes is a requirement for any team that judges itself on performance. It should be noted here that results are not limited to financial measures like profit, revenue, or shareholder returns. Though it is true that many organizations in a capitalist economic environment ultimately measure their success in these terms, this dysfunction refers to a far broader definition of results, one that is related to outcome-based performance. Every good organization specifies what it plans to achieve in a given period, and these goals, more than the financial metrics that they drive, make up the majority of near-term controllable results. So, while profit may be the ultimate measure of results for a corporation, the goals and objectives that executives set for themselves along the way constitute a more representative example of the results it strives for as a team. Ultimately, these goals drive profit. But what would a team be focused on other than results? Team status and individual status are the prime candidates. Team status. For members of some teams, merely being part of the group is enough to keep them satisfied. For them, the achievement of specific results might be desirable, but not necessarily worthy of great sacrifice or inconvenience. As ridiculous and dangerous as this might seem, plenty of teams fall prey to the lure of status. These often include altruistic nonprofit organizations that come to believe that the nobility of their mission is enough to justify their satisfaction. Political groups, academic departments, and prestigious companies are also susceptible to this dysfunction, as they often see success in merely being associated with their special organizations. Individual status. This refers to the familiar tendency of people to focus on enhancing their own positions or career prospects at the expense of their team. Though all human beings have an innate tendency toward self-preservation, a functional team must make the collective results of the group more important to each individual than individual members' goals. As obvious as this dysfunction might seem at first glance, and as clear as it is that it must be avoided, it is important to note that many teams are simply not results-focused. They do not live and breathe in order to achieve meaningful objectives, but rather merely to exist or survive. Unfortunately for these groups, no amount of trust, conflict, commitment, or accountability can compensate for a lack of desire to win. Suggestions for overcoming dysfunction 5. How does a team go about ensuring that its attention is focused on results? By making results clear and rewarding only those behaviors and actions that contribute to those results. Public declaration of results. In the mind of a football or basketball coach, one of the worst things a team member can do is publicly guarantee that his or her team will win an upcoming game. In the case of an athletic team, this is a problem because it can unnecessarily provoke an opponent. For most teams, however, it can be helpful to make public proclamations about intended success. Teams that are willing to commit publicly to specific results are more likely to work with a passionate, even desperate desire to achieve those results. Teams that say, "We'll do our best," are subtly, if not purposefully, preparing themselves for failure. Results-based rewards. An effective way to ensure that team members focus their attention on results is to tie the rewards, especially compensation, to the achievement of specific outcomes. Relying on this alone can be problematic because it assumes that financial motivation is the sole driver of behavior. Still, letting someone take home a bonus merely for trying hard, even in the absence of results, sends a message that achieving the outcome may not be terribly important after all. The role of the leader. Perhaps more than any of the other dysfunctions, the leader must set the tone for a focus on results. If team members sense that the leader values anything other than results, they will take that as permission to do the same for themselves. Team leaders must be selfless and objective and reserve rewards and recognition for those who make real contributions to the achievement of group goals. Summary. As much information as is contained here, the reality remains that teamwork ultimately comes down to practicing a small set of principles over a long period of time. Success is not a matter of mastering subtle, sophisticated theory, but rather of embracing common sense with uncommon levels of discipline and persistence. Ironically, teams succeed because they are exceedingly human. By acknowledging the imperfections of their humanity, members of functional teams overcome the natural tendencies that make trust, conflict, commitment, accountability, and a focus on results so elusive. A note about time, Catherine's methods. Catherine understood that a strong team spends considerable time together, and that by doing so, they actually save time by eliminating confusion and minimizing redundant effort and communication. Added together, Catherine and her team spent approximately 8 days each quarter in regularly scheduled meetings, which amounts to fewer than 3 days per month. As little as this seems when considered as a whole, most management teams balk at spending this much time together, preferring to do real work instead. Though there are actually many different ways to run a management team, Catherine's methods are worth considering. Following is a description of how she ran her staff after her initial team-building off-sites and the significant investment in time that it required. Annual planning meeting and leadership development retreats, 3 days off-site. Topics might include budget discussions, major strategic planning overview, leadership training, succession planning, and cascading messaging. Quarterly staff meetings, 2 days off-site. Topics might include major goal reviews, financial review, strategic discussions, employee performance discussions, key issue resolution, team development, and cascading messages. Weekly staff meetings, 2 hours on-site. Topics might include key activity review, goal progress review, sales review, customer review, tactical issue resolution, cascading messages. Ad hoc topical meetings, 2 hours on-site. Topics might include strategic issues that cannot be adequately discussed during weekly staff meetings. We hope you've enjoyed this unabridged production of The Five Dysfunctions of a Team, a Leadership Fable, by Patrick Lencioni. This program was produced and directed by John McElroy. The executive producer, Karen D. Mattia. Text copyright 2002 by Patrick Lencioni. Production copyright 2002 by Random House, Inc. All rights reserved.